paper 27, right at the beginning, which is old single column, page 298. Okay, well, I guess the thing that we need to just remind ourselves of is the last section of the previous paper and the first section of this paper are a pair. Remember, we were going through in the previous paper, we were going through the secondary supernafim, and we're working our way in the Havona circles. We got to the first circle, and the for ascenders, they're called the complements of rest, those secondary supernafim that are working with you all the way around. And, you know, it's a great example with that name. They're doing a lot more than just helping out with that final phase of the transition from the first circle of Amona to the Isle of Paradise. So they're doing a lot more than just being a complement of rest, but the Revelators have to pick some name. Like we pointed out, with both of those last two flavors of secondary supernafim, they're doing a lot of things that we can't even remotely imagine. We can put, you know, general words to them, absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, absolute, but, you know, they picked a name that was something that we can deal with more directly. And it does help with just what we're doing here tonight to remind you of the connection between the secondaries and the primary supernafim. You know, that first group of primary supernafim are a lot more than instigators of rest also, because obviously they're working with you after you've woken up. So is, you know, it's a great example of both these names. They've chosen to just name the two of them to mark that very significant transition from time to eternity. But the complements have a whole bunch before that point, and the instigators have a whole bunch to do after that point. And they, if you remember, they pointed out that while you're still there in Havona, these instigators of rest we're about to read about, one of them actually comes out to the first circle of Havona and really works with the complements, so that they're actually a complementary pair at that point, working on that first circle of Havona. So the last part of your journey through the first circle, you have both the complement and the instigator there with you, helping you with that final, very difficult climb to get to the point where you're ready to have a direct relationship with the absolute existential level in your inner life, obviously. But, you know, it takes both of them to get you to that point. So, you know, if you remember, that's the way they ended it. They kind of gave you that little thing, and then they started to talk a little bit about the whole concept of rest. And we're going to pick that up again when we get to the instigators of rest. Okay, but in the meantime, in the preface, they're going to just give us a little bit of a background here, and we get some fun little tidbits on the side. Before we actually get to going through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different flavors of primary supernafim. So let's start up here.
Paper 27, Ministry of the Primary Supernafim. Primary supernafim are the supernal servants of the deities on the eternal Isle of Paradise. Never have they been known to depart from the paths of light and righteousness. The roll calls are complete. From eternity, not one of these magnificent hosts has been lost. These high supernafim are perfect beings, supreme in perfection, but they are not absonite. Neither are they absolute. Being of the essence of perfection, these children of the infinite spirit work interchangeably and at will in all phases of their manifold duties. They do not function extensively outside paradise. though they do participate in the various millennial gatherings and group reunions of the central universe. They also go forth as special messengers of the deities, and in large numbers they ascend to become technical advisors.
Okay. So you notice it hasn't changed from the previous paper, that they're stressing that still what you're up to is coming into a relationship with deity. You know, see, they're calling them the servants of the deities and the messengers of the deities. Not so much a personal messenger, but a servant or a messenger of the, the character of self, of deity self, that is fundamentally in play, with whatever deity you're attempting to engage. Okay. So there's that aspect that it's the deities again, and then. Notice how they carefully worded that in the middle. These high Supernafim are perfect beings, supreme in perfection. Not supreme in completion, not that far, but they are at least supreme in perfection. So when at the end there, when they say in large numbers they ascend to become technical advisors, ascend. They're speaking to that going beyond the perfection point that they start in. Like we've talked about so many times, you achieve perfection and then you go on to completion. Okay, so that's what they would be doing, is pushing forward in some measure of gaining some measure, gaining some measure of completion built upon that initial perfection. And then just the fact, it's kind of interesting. Now, if you think back, maybe if you can, to when we spent a whole bunch of time talking about the technical advisors, and when we were talking about that group and how there's different types of angels that can achieve that status, when they gave you kind of a thumbnail sketch of the kind of training that an angel has to go through to become a technical advisor, they were sort of doing it in a bottom-up picture, like basically imagining that a seraphim was working its way up from the Melchizedek University of their local universe, and then getting to the super universe capital, and then going through each of the circuits of Avona, and then the final touches on the Isle of Paradise. Well, the very fact that they say ascend, adds an interesting touch to that. One can wonder, it's like, if you say ascend, you're thinking of this vertical phenomenon. But they obviously can't, they start on paradise. You can't think of that as literally up like our ascent. But like we pointed out, when someone is starting on paradise, when they go down, that's an ascent for them. So you have to kind of wonder, do you suppose maybe they do it in reverse order? They start in that school on paradise, come down through the Avona circles, then go to a super universe capital, and then maybe a local universe capital. I mean, is there some sort of like a reciprocal ascent here for them? Just a possibility, the fact that they specifically use the word ascend in there. Now, the other little thing to keep in mind here, as we read the next one, they're going to give you an example of a special messenger of the deities. However, when they say, let's see, where was it? Friend Heckard said that most of them are on paradise. Oh, they do not function extensively outside paradise. As you'll see in the next block, there must be a reasonable number of them out and about, or the logistics of the next paragraph doesn't work. So I think, you know, when they say something, you know, in this instance, when they say they do not function extensively outside of paradise, and remember there's probably an unbelievable number of them. So, you know, in fractional terms, maybe a lot of them aren't out there in the seven super universes, but in terms of just, you know, raw numbers, it's probably a lot. So that there's enough to make the logistics of the next thing we're going to read about work. All right. So, and maybe just another thing, you know, the whole fact that you have these beings that are described as supernal servants of the deities, and then they remind you that they would ascend to become a technical advisor, just like we talked about with those technical advisors. I mean, your initial spiritual consciousness, you know, is not impressed by that name. But it's actually something very, very refined, very, very high in quality, you know, and it's again, reminds you of that challenge that you have in front of you to not, in your initial sense of individuality consciousness, material consciousness, don't be too quick to assume that there's no great potential for quality there. You know, that all the quality is coming from your unity consciousness. That's not the case. You may have to get a lot of relationship with unity to get the kind of high quality in that individuality, but it's the potential is there. Yeah, Pam.
So they come from the infinite spirit. So they're children of the infinite spirit.
Right, children of the infinite spirit, the primary ones.
But why does it say they have never been known to depart from the paths of life and righteousness, and they're perfect beings? So why would it even mention that? Because they can still, they can still go astray.
They're pointing out that you're now at an angel that's definitively high enough that they can't entertain rebellion. You know, what it said that they're supreme in perfection just by nature. A seraphim is not supreme in perfection by nature. They can go astray.
It doesn't say that. Just says, never have they been known to depart from the paths of
life. Right. Just like they also say that about creator sons. No one has ever known a creator son to go astray, they say. Mm-hmm. And you're going, it's like God. I mean, isn't that ridiculous to say that God has never gone astray? Now, so when I say that, does that help to answer the question? I mean, think about what was the understanding that we always get there. There is absolute free will in this creature. They have all of the ability to choose rebellion. It's not like they're a machine that can't rebel. Just like a creator son is not a machine that can't rebel. They have complete free will to rebel. They could choose that without any blockage in their way. They're totally free to choose rebellion. But they never do. Why? Because they are supreme in perfection. They're perfect. Even without, it's like with us, no mortal has ever gone astray once they fused, which is, you know, just a little ways up from your mortal world usually. You know, you're fusing. So, and it's like, well, you're such a limited fact at that point. I mean, why couldn't you go astray? Well, you've grabbed a hold of a father fragment. And you've, even though you're very limited in general, you have this one little thread of supreme perfection that's locked onto the adjuster, and so now there's no breaking free. A primary supernovim doesn't have a father fragment that they're latched onto. They don't have that sort of gift of grace of integrity. Mm-hmm. So their whole mindal self, not just one little thread, their whole mindal self has to be rock solid. There can't be a weak point anywhere in it. I mean, as a, you know, when you think in terms of the technical nature of us, when we fuse, we have all kinds of weak points in us still. But they're all made strong enough by that one little thread that's locked onto the adjuster. If we didn't have that thread, you still have weak points in you that could, you know, lead you astray, but not while you're also holding on. So that's the difference. But it's just, you know, it's very important. You know, we talked about this back a ways when we got into, like, the technical advisors and stuff. When we were talking about all the laws and, you know, everyone started to sound like a machine. Remember, and they immediately reminded us that these are persons. Because they knew we were starting to kind of get lost in the machine quality of what they were talking about. It's very hard for us to imagine that some being that's made such a high, perfect machine isn't just a machine. Like, and the flip of that, the adjuster is not a person. It's really, in many ways, just a really fancy machine. See, you know, it works both ways. There, an adjuster doesn't go astray because it's a very perfect machine. the way it works here, you have the combination of a perfect enough machine and a personality identified with it that has, you know, so it has clarity of recognition. It recognizes the quality of the machine that it is, this supreme perfection machine, and knows that's just right. And it would be ridiculous to do anything except be that. We, like right now, I could find some little, you know, spot in my mindful self and fall in love with it and say that that's adequate for everything, and I'm delusional. But they don't have that. The reason that I can do that is because most of my mind is still opaque. It's very low quality. And so I might see this little part and think it's everything, but there's really all this stuff that I can't see that is far from the glory that I think I'm seeing here. That isn't the case with this primary supernafim. You know, they look into their mindful self and it's clear. They can see to the margins, you know, and so they can't delude themselves. There's no blind spots because their mind is made transparent for them, where it's not for us right now. Yeah.
How can you refer to them as machine?
Well, in the sense of, you know, if you set the personality aside and just think about the mindful self. Just a mindful self, like an adjuster, is just a mindful self. Obviously, in this case, you know, you have a personality, but like I said, just imagine that's not there. So how would you describe an energy phenomenon and its workings? Yeah, it's basically a fancy machine. It's a minded machine, like, for instance, a Frandelank. You know, it's this very incredible mindful self, but it's not a personality. And they say if you were to observe it, it would seem like a machine to you. But it's living. It's a living minded machine. Well, what's an example of that that we can understand better? A plant. A plant is a minded machine, doesn't have personality. You know, if you just get in and study the mechanics of the plant, it just seems like this really fancy machine. So much so that scientists, you know, in general, believe that it is just a machine, that there's no mind there. The mind is so imperceptible. In the same way that Lucifer can look out in the universe and say, no, there's no God. It's just a machine. See, but actually, it's perfect mind, grabbing a hold of every automaton and doing with it as it, you know, as it wills. You know, but it's so perfect that for an ignorant person like Lucifer, it looks like it's just a machine. Even God looks like a machine to Lucifer. So that's what I'm getting at. I mean, you know, just remember your mindful self is just an energy phenomenon. It has certain, you know, like just consider our mindful self. It has certain pre-programmed settings that come from your genetics. And it's just a machine and it plays out its programming. And it will just continue to play out its programming unless your personality wills it to do something that wasn't in the original programming. And the challenge is just to remember that what we think of as personality, by and large, is not. It's self-assertion. And that stuff that we think is very original that we do, by and large, isn't. It can be calculated in advance. It's like, well, how can that be? I mean, it feels like I've never had anything to do with this, and now I'm bringing in this whole brand new thing, and I'm doing it. I think I'm using my personality. And your angel says, no, I calculated that years ago. Okay? Why does it seem like you're doing something totally original? Like I said, you can see about this much of your mind, and the rest is opaque. You don't even know it's there. And if occasionally you bring in something out of that opaque space, it looks like you did something creative, that you actually used your personality, but all you did is just use more of the machine than you've been using in the past. You know? That's fundamentally, you know, most of what people do that they think is original is just something has allowed them to have a little bit more capacity of consciousness. And all of a sudden, there's these new things there that they didn't know, you know, they've never seen before. But you didn't actually create them, quote unquote, you know, that actual unique personality. They're just more of the machine coming into play. And that machine can assert itself, self-assertion. That very fact, see, as I was saying, that's why it's easy for us to get into problems where it isn't for a primary support of him, because they can see the whole mindful self. But, you know, if you just bring another phase of your temperament that's tuned to your genetics into view, and you declare that this is a godlike act, that you've just created this incredible new thing, you apply your absolute dimension of your personality to it, you absolutize it, you know, you deify it in your mind, you know, and you start thinking that it's a solution to everyone's problems and, you know, whatnot. That's why it's so easy for us to be deluded, because we don't start out clearly seeing what we are. If we could really see how limited we are from border to border, it would be much easier for us to be humble and much less frequent that we go astray. Even to the point where maybe we would never go astray, like the primary supernatum, never go astray.
Yeah. It seems, in one way, the writer is paying respect to the free will of the supernatum, saying it is theoretically possible to rebel, but the probability is nil. Yeah, it's never happened.
Yeah. But you know how they, you notice how they always talk about this when they bring it up. It's not like anyone's assuming anything. They know they have absolute free will. So it doesn't matter if they have a supremely perfect mind. They have something bigger than that. They have absolute free will that could send that supreme perfection astray, but it doesn't. Because, you know, like you're saying, it's a little tip of the hat to God the Father. Isn't this a cool thing that the Father doles out, this personality? That it knows when what it has is right and doesn't try to change it, doesn't think...
One personality.
No, I'm putting the two together. Oh. Isn't it wonderful, see, that, you know, that Father's personality is a fact that can discern when something is right. Doesn't presume it knows better. Well, God thinks this, but I think this. The revelation says this, but I think this. You know, the supreme seraphim, supernatum never says that. You know, it can see it, and nowhere, it knows where this perfect self came from. And it knows it, it sees it, it recognizes it as perfect and wouldn't try to change one iota of it. To rebel, see, would be for it to say, well, you know, actually, this could be tweaked, this little part. I'll leave the, no, it can't change one little notch, you know, in a fundamental sense. And it doesn't, because it, you know, it can see what it is, and it can see the universal harmony, it can see the cosmos, compares the two. Yep, they're the same. I'm right with the cosmos, and I'm not going to change one iota of it. Okay, now, actually, talking all this about rebellion and whatnot actually feeds you into the next paragraph. let's get in this next little bit here.
Primary Supernifim are also placed in command of the seraphic hosts ministering on worlds isolated because of rebellion. When a paradise son is bestowed upon such a world, completes his mission, ascends to the Universal Father, is accepted and returns as the accredited deliverer of this isolated world, a primary supernifim is always designated by the chiefs of assignment to assume command of the ministering spirits on duty in the newly reclaimed sphere. Supernifim in this special service are periodically rotated. On Urantia, the present, quote, chief of seraphim, end quote, is the second of this order to be on duty since the times of the bestowal of Christ Michael.
Okay, so this is this fun, the spot in the book where they give you this little tidbit. You know, a tidbit that you might expect to find somewhere up in one of the rebellion papers or something. Here's where it is. It's in the preface of the primary Supernifim paper that they give you this little detail. You know, we all know, we even have a paper written by this chief of Seraphim. Okay, so we have one of these primary Supernifim functioning ever since Pentecost as the chief of Seraphim. Okay, and see, so you notice at the beginning there, it says that when a paradise son is bestowed. Okay, so not talking about a magisterial mission. It's got to be a bestowal mission. You know, either a magisterial son or a creator son. It's got to be on a bestowal mission. Goes through the whole process of you know, going to the Father, coming back, and you know, Spirit of Truth being poured out. And then obviously, just like with our world, sort of a new order is set up to some degree. And finally, there's someone that really takes charge of the Seraphim again, one of these primary Supernifim. And, you know, you notice that, you know, this is very interesting, that they're rotated. And like they're saying, the second of this order to be on this duty, you see, is right now. So in other words, apparently, they serve for 1,000 years. So the current primary Supernifim, the current chief of Seraphim, is going to be due to be rotated out in 2030. You know, just like the resident governor general's rotating out. Only this is every 1,000 years instead of every 100 years, like the resident governor general. But the funny thing about that, it's like, okay, so they serve for a 1,000-year stint. They serve for a Paradise Avona
day.
Day.
Wow. Just in the neighborhood.
So, from that Paradise Avona spec, you know, they're coming from paradise. You know, in that, when they think about what they're doing, their job in that temporal perspective, it's a day's job. It's just that they're serving for one day.
I got this thing to do, and I'll be right back tomorrow.
Right. One day. The interesting thing, you know, and then of course, you know, they reminded us that again, you know, this sort of time scale up in the previous paragraph, how they participate in the various millennial gatherings. You know, we know what millennial means. How many years? You? No, well, 1,000, but in our years. Remember, a day is a thousand years.
Yeah. Oh,
100 days is a year.
Yeah, that's
1,000 years is a millennium. So in our, you know, one of their paradise of Ona millennia is 100 million years, right? We've mentioned that several times. You know, just remember, when they use that in the context of the central universe, that's 100 million years. That's what, you know, you're dealing with them occasionally doing things, you know, every 100 million years, and they have this job for a day. Literally, just one day. But the funny thing, when you look at it in those terms, you remember, you know, that paper. You go up, read that paper by the chief of Seraphim that I'm thinking of. You know, remember which paper that is? Seraphic Planetary Government. You know, and remember how in the beginning they're speculating about Machiavendi Melchizedek. Do you remember what he says there? How, you know, some celestials think that Machiavendi might not come for, you know, a long time, blah, blah, blah. Next dispensation. Yeah, what does he say?
Any
day or hour. You know, and now, you know, he means one of our days or ours, okay? But it's pretty funny when you think about it in this context. It's like, well, yeah, for one of your days or ours.
Yeah,
it might be hundreds of years if it's ours. But
standing around the water cooler like that.
But it adds a new twist to that, to the, you know, the impatience of that. You know, here he's. I mean, for that, it's like, you know, any nanosecond. You know, that's what he's saying. It's pretty funny to think about the two in contrast. All right, so. So the thing, remember I pointed out, so just think about this. If a primary Supernovim became chief of Seraphim 2,000 years ago, he didn't come from paradise.
Right.
Okay. At three times the speed of light. Okay. You know, takes him hundreds of, you know, thousands of years. Yeah, so there's got to be some primary Supernovim that are right, you know, probably on Gerasim.
Yeah.
See, one could just be sent here at Pentecost.
Aren't we an archangel
headquarters and all that sort of thing. You know, but just, you know, just thinking about that whole statement about, you know, they do not function extensively outside paradise. It's like, well, okay, obviously there's got to be some. What was that?
The next paragraph. Since they've gone forth on missions of leadership to worlds of space.
Right, right. And I'm just pointing out that going forth to worlds on, you know, I mean, that's not, they're not all sitting on paradise and heading out, you know, when they're called to duty, because it takes a long time. I mean, just to go from Uversa, you know, to here is 200,000 light years. At three times the speed of light, that's what, 67,000 years? It's a long time. Right. You know, so you're not, you know, they're not, you know, being dispatched from Uversa, you know, when Michael, you know, bestowed the Spirit of Truth and set up the planetary government. He's obviously being dispatched from very locally, probably Gerasim. So just wanted, you know, between the lines, you can tell that they are out and about, all out, you know, so that they can be, whenever they're needed, like for jobs like this, they're local. Otherwise, you know, they would have had to plan this, you know, before Andon and Fonta, you know. It's like, this doesn't work, right? Okay.
From eternity, the primary Supernovim have served on the Isle of Light and have gone forth on missions of leadership to the worlds of space. But they have functioned as now classified only since the arrival on paradise of the Havona Pilgrims of Time. These high angels now minister chiefly in the following seven orders of service. 1, conductors of worship. 2, masters of philosophy. 3, custodians of knowledge. 4, directors of conduct. 5, interpreters of ethics. 6, chiefs of assignment, 7 instigators of rest.
Okay, so we're leading up to this connection between instigators of rest and the compliments. And you see a similar thing. Remember what they said about the secondary supernovim? That they went into duty when Grand Fanda landed on the pilot world of the Seventh Circuit? So here, they were doing, who knows what, forever. And then when the first ones landed on Paradise, so not when they landed in Avona, but not until they actually landed on Paradise, then they went into this mode. So these angels are all, really responding in the moment. It's kind of an interesting thing that it's not planned way in advance in a sense in terms of actually laying them out. They switch gears quickly to a new task. And you'll see they mention that they're by design very adaptable. Remember how we've been focusing on that? They're coming from, like Pam said, the infinite spirit, third source and center, the infinite mind, that fundamental adaptability of mind. So that, not surprising, they're like mind nuggets, they're little mindal agents, and they can immediately adapt, like mind should adapt to the circumstance. And so if they're told, go do this job, they totally switch gears, and boom, they're right on it.
These guys are deployed in Havona to service ascending, right?
These are the primary supernovim. But the instigators of rest, like we said, go out to the first circuit, but not. You may run into them on the other circuits and stuff, but they're not, guiding you through.
But they're in the first circuit, where. Weren't they having to be on the first circuit for the first ascenders to do what they did?
Well, see, that's, I see what you're getting at.
That's
yeah, that little technique, yeah. So you got a question that you don't know the answer to. How precisely should you read that? If it says, they now minister, or how do they say that? Classified only since the arrival on Paradise. Maybe there was a primary supernovim that went out, some primary supernovim that went out and helped those first ones, but they weren't technically called instigators of rest yet. Maybe that's the way you interpret that.
Yeah.
I think probably you have to interpret it that way, because they're about to point out, they're indispensable, those primary supernovim, to you making that transition. So I don't think those first ascenders could have done it without them.
Yeah.
So I think that's the way you would have to interpret that, is that that they took on these roles of what they do on the aisle once there were ascenders on the aisle for them to guide through, which just kind of speaks to what I was saying up front. An instigator of rest is a lot more than an instigator of rest.
Yeah.
See, so maybe that's the best, just to think about it that way, that really that's pointing out that they've given them that name, but that's just that initial little thing they do, and really they've got a lot of things that go beyond that whole rest transition.
Yeah, I've got another question.
Yep.
Just to make sure that I've heard you right. You said they're not personalities?
They are personalities.
Okay, yeah. And that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, we were just abstracting. We were just trying to, think about their self and their personality separately, And you have this very high-quality self, and then a personality identifies with it.
I was thinking, they come from the infinite spirit, so that's probably why he's saying that they're not a personality, because they didn't come directly from the Father. I'm trying to rationalize how
No. Yeah, that was... for the people on the webinar, what Pam is asking there is... is about the issue about whether or not the primary supernovim are personalities or not. Now, they definitely are personalities, and it's it's just that issue of over and over again they try to help you, and so I was doing the same thing, to remember to separate the self and the personality. Think about them in two parts, and then put them together. And that statement is, like I was saying, is really predicated on the quality of the self part, not somehow that they get a personality that is not allowed to go rebellious or something. It's a hogtied personality. I mean, no, it's a fully free personality, just like every other creature personality. Remember, there's no difference in creature personalities. There's two flavors of personality, creator and creature. So, I mean, they get a personality in an existential sense that it's exactly like mine. Now, the big difference is the identity. Once that personality engages the self for them is a lot higher quality than myself. Okay? My poor personality has to engage this lowly self and try to do something with it. And the first challenge that it has is to not be delusional, to not falsely exalt what little self it sees into a complete lifestyle solution. okay. Let's read some more.
Not until the ascending pilgrims actually attain paradise residence do they come under the direct influence of these supernafim. And then they pass through a training experience under the direction of these angels in the reverse order of their naming. That is, you enter upon your paradise career under the tutelage of the instigators of rest, and after successive seasons with the intervening orders, finish this training period with the conductors of worship. Thereupon, are you ready to begin the endless career of a finaliter?
You can kind of see it there, Chris. See? Under the direct influence.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's the proper way to interpret that statement. That's what they're speaking to. You know, that, like I was saying, it's the whole tutelage thing that, that gives them seven categories like this. What you name each of the seven categories, in English, is a secondary issue. And like I was saying up front, they've chosen to name the first one something that ties you to the transition rather than the tutelage. Whereas the other ones, are telling you about much more about the tutelage, except the chief's assignment. They're similar, but definitely interpreters of ethics, directors of conduct, et cetera. That's a name that's really about what they're trying to teach you.
Yeah. It's interesting, the sixth paragraph in the last paper that we read talks about them coming out from paradise,
right,
to prepare the pilgrims to begin that rest of transition.
And that's what we're just going to get here now. We're going to talk a lot about that whole concept of rest and what it is that they're preparing you for, exactly how to think about that. Why have they chosen to use this term rest in both the complements of rest and the instigators of rest? I mean, why, why not the instigators of transition or something, or transformation, or, why rest? So let's read a little bit here.
One. Instigators of rest. The instigators of rest are the inspectors of paradise who go forth from the central aisle to the inner circuit of Havona, there to collaborate with their colleagues, the complements of rest of the secondary order of supernafim. The one essential to the enjoyment of paradise is rest, divine rest. And these instigators of rest are the final instructors who make ready the pilgrims of time for their introduction to eternity. They begin their work on the final attainment circle of the central universe and continue it when the pilgrim awakes from the last transition sleep, the slumber which graduates a creature of space into the realm of the eternal.
Okay, so just the first little bit about the word rest there. Notice how they're stressing that you can see between the lines how they're connecting the word rest to the aisle. The fact of what the uh, what what it's like to be a resident of the Isle. So we've talked about this a lot of times. You know, one of the fundamental elements of the revelation, it's a universe of motion. Everything is a motion. Right? That's like, well, motion relative to what? Relative to the Isle of Paradise, which is motionless. It's at rest. Okay? That's the contrast. In order to actually fully engage the economy of the Isle of Paradise, not just be kind of in a little self-bubble when you're there trying to find one of the three persons, but to actually be able to engage the economy, you have to engage a domain that is at rest, in the sense relative to the only thing that you've ever known, the universe of motion. Not things that are at rest that are in motion. There isn't anything out here that's at rest. There is no rest out here. It's all motion. It's all restless. Right? The incessant clamoring of inescapable self. See, why do we start out that way? See, because we're fundamentally restless. We're fundamentally in contrast to the Isle. We need to master that restlessness. Master that motion and guide it into wise paths. But we can't say, well, I don't want to be a motion and learn how to guide it. Can I just be at rest? No. You're an experiential being. You're not an existential being. You can't just be at rest. One must do something as well as be something. See, why is the must? Because if you aren't doing something, you're not real. Out here, you're not an existential being. You're not the universal father.
Nothing restful about striking steps.
Okay, so see they're just about to educate us a little bit more in thinking about this contrast between time and eternity, between motion and rest, between experiential and existential. You have to strike step with, like we've said a few times, one way to describe that place of rest, that Isle of Paradise, that place that is motionless, is a place where the sequence is existential. It just is. It's at rest, see? It's not in motion. You know, it just is, and you have to figure it out and walk within it.
Yeah. So existential beings don't have to do anything?
But there's only one existential being, the Universal Father. There's only one purely existential being. You know, the closest he gets to the experiential is self-experiential deity. But that's it. But the other, you know, even the next two persons, the second and third persons of paradise, are not purely existential. They start out with an existential core, but they wrap an experiential nature around that. The eternal Son becomes the eternal Mother Son, and the infinite Spirit becomes the infinite Mother Spirit. So they know motion. The Father knows motion not. There's no relationship to motion.
No, it's not motion.
Right? I was being biblical there.
We're going against our nature if we just are like this, because that's mm-hmm. only the Creator, the Father does that. The Eternal Son has to be in motion. Everybody has to be in motion. So.
Yes. So for the people on the webinar, what Pam was just pointing out there, I mean, she's recognizing that we're really going against our nature if we try to just, you know, exist, try to just be, you know, present, et cetera. Yeah, think about all of the false doctrine that you were all born into about this. You know, all of these gurus out there and whatnot that are trying to teach you the path to enlightenment by trying to get you to become completely at rest. To slow you down to just in an existential state, to just exist. If you achieve that, you cease to exist, actually.
That would be impossible to achieve.
Then that's why that's a dangerous thing to actually be cultivated. That's why it says one must do something as well as be something. You know, they know we've had this tendency to fixate on the Father and his existentialness. Because of our heightened spiritual consciousness, what Michael did 2,000 years ago. He got it so that we can really get enamored with the existentialness of the Father and create whole ideologies fixated on his state of rest. Yeah? But the irony is, you know, if you actually achieve that, you will cease to exist out here. Out here, you have to fundamentally be in motion. Yep.
Isn't it a matter of balance between
them? The balance, right. You know, so like we said, the Father is the initiator. Just the initiator, not the goal. And that's the problem with these doctrines. They make existentialness the goal, not the beginning. I mean, if you want to focus on existentialness, it's a simple little thing. Oh my goodness, I exist. Okay, now what's the next subject? It doesn't take a guru, you know, to explain you that path to that. There is no path. It's a dot. It's a point. It's your starting point. Just recognize it. Okay, and now what? You know, you can't dwell there. But you have to start there. So, instigators of rest, like an initiator. See, so now you're starting to see it in a little different light. You're dealing with these higher angels will have a little bit more father-like character to them. And especially you see like this one, when you see it in this new light, what he's much more than initiating your rest so that you can transition from Havana to paradise. Think about it in bigger terms. He's helping initiate the rest of your career. He's helping to foster a new father point, a new initiation point that you can go forward from. You're from that point on, your life extends from eternity rather than from time, some point in time. He makes eternity your new beginning. Just like a paradise citizen, that's their starting point. They go, you're getting reinitiated so that you have a starting point like in a paradise citizen, where you start with eternity and then you go out to time in a new way. Yeah, we got a couple things here. Yeah, go ahead.
Is it too crude to think of this in terms of if you go to a new country where you've never been before and somebody meets you and introduces you to the culture, to the language, to the life there.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a little crude, but because there's such a change.
Yeah, I mean, certainly all of these primary supernafim together, as you read through this paper, have that full quality. That full quality that you're pointing out, kind of getting you acclimated to a whole new culture, you know, where everything is different. And this first one, the instigator of rest, is just the one that's starting that acclimation process. And it's you see how his job is going to be a very father-like role of helping you to be reinitiated, so that eternity can be a starting point for you. Just see how it's just turning everything around. Like we said, there's two. Normally, we think of eternity as in the experiential sense. I'm going through this long line of time until I get to eternity. Technically, that's existential eternity. I mean, experiential eternity. We're talking about existential eternity now. The eternity that it always has existed, not the eternity that will only exist when we all get to the all, the infinite all are, you know, until we get to the completion of God the ultimate and all that sort of stuff. Okay. We're talking about an eternity that always was, always is, and always will be, that is timeless, a timeless eternity, an existential eternity. And you're going to take a hold of that existential eternity as a new initiation. So he's instigating you into eternity, into existential eternity.
And I think I know why. Mm-hmm. Because when they take you into that divine rest, then that's where the Father is. And so that they give you that comes down to you in his energy form, and that's where you have true rest. And then that's why they say you're ready for eternal life.
Yeah, I'll point to that. She was for the people on the webinar. She's just pointing to where we're about to get in as we read through these different stages of rest, this relationship to the Father. You notice how they'll build us to that here in the next three paragraphs. And we'll talk about that here in a second. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You want to got something?
Word,
yeah.
Well, the word rest mm-hmm. as a time of quiet, mm-hmm. and then also looking at the word rest as beginning for something, like the rest of the story.
Ah.
So the word rest has a double meaning.
Yeah. Yeah.
On your beginning point to eternity.
Yeah, that's a fun little thought. Yeah. The play on words there also, it works. Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't say instigators of the rest. But
the rest of experiential eternity. Right. Okay.
Thank you.
Chris? Oh, that's right. There was a question over here. Sorry. So many questions. Yeah.
Oh,
you're on.
No, that's all right.
You want to just leave it aside? Okay.
Well, and I have a quick comment.
Okay.
As the paradise citizens come out,
mm-hmm.
Is there an instigator of motion for them?
Ooh, aren't you thinking? Might have something to do with that first secondary supernatum that they engage on the first circuit.
What did he say?
What he said is he's wondering if, when the paradise citizens come down and do their descending through the circles of Avona, seems like there must be, you must need an instigator of motion in some way.
Or unrest, yeah.
On that first circle of Avona, yep, exactly. See, that's the kind of thing to be thinking about. Yeah, you can begin, like I said, if you just think about it, you can understand what those secondary supernatum are doing.
Sure.
On each of the circuits for the descenders.
Yeah. I'm assuming for the rest of our entire eternal existence is what to do. We're always thinking, you know, what should I do?
Yeah, and so, I mean, for those on the webinar, maybe one thing I can just, I can pull out of her comments there for you is that relationship, you know, that she's speaking to that relationship that we'll have to the Isle of Paradise. And out here, you know, it's always, well, what am I supposed to do? What am I supposed to do? You know, which is a very appropriate question as we're beginning to recognize, because that's what it's all about, doing something out here. But there, you can just be what you are existentially, you know, your personality from the Father. You can have a relationship to that existential domain because you're given a personality from the purely existential God. He gives you that gift that one day you can relate to where He is. And the irony and the imponderable is that, so you leave the universe of motion behind for a while, and you go to this motionless domain of the Isle of Paradise. But in terms of your personality, it will be the most liberated it can ever be when it's there. It's the most fluid when it's there. It can't be as fluid out here. And I'm purposely saying something like fluid instead of motion because, you know, you don't want to really use the word motion because it's motionless. It doesn't have the kind of motion that we understand. And yet there will be liberty you won't be frozen, you know, there. You will be finally free. Totally, absolutely free for the first time.
Even free of motion.
Yeah, even free of the motion that we currently know. Right. You can transcend that, go beyond that, be more moving than motion allows.
Right.
I don't know if Howard wants me to share the whole thing, but I thought it was really interesting comment that he made. He said, regarding rest, on our level one recall, that mind engages matter and not spirit. That would seem to fit with what he was saying about the mistake gurus make by telling us to achieve complete rest in order to achieve greater spirituality. So, you know, it's the you know, what impacts what? I mean, you know, what impacts physical, what impacts spiritual, what impacts, you know.
Yeah, I mean, so maybe just a quick comment, and then we'll get going here again. Think about when you really, the irony that, you know, it's sad to record that most people on this planet, including me, you know, no one ever not include me in that, don't really know what personality is, don't know really know what true liberty is, because it's so hard for us to actualize much of our personality, to actually experience that, know that here. So you get this little insight into the existential father. You start looking for something that seems at rest, like what you sense through your spiritual insight of the nature of the father. The only thing that you can see as you look around is matter, which seems to be motionless, seems to be just billiard balls just sitting there. So you actually end up, you know, having a the ironic tendency to fixate on the lower material domains of your mind, that's on the surface seems to be bound to the rock that you're sitting on. So instead of looking up, you actually look down. There's a whole bunch of problems with this false identification with what your goal should be. You're trying to get up from the lower domain of the hourglass into the upper domain where it's more in motion. You know, eventually getting up to, you have Marantia mind and you have a quality in it that's called moda, literally the word motion. But instead, you start focusing more down in the bowels of the lower domain of the hourglass, trying to find this great goal of existence, pure existence. So you're actually looking in the opposite direction. And it's going to lead to navel gazing, introspection, all these things, you know, when you're not looking up and out then. All right. Okay, so now let's get this neat little stuff about rest.
Rest is of a sevenfold nature. There is the rest of sleep and of play in the lower life orders.
That's one, those two together. Mm-hmm.
Discovery in the higher beings and worship in the highest type of spirit personality. There is also the normal rest of energy intake, the recharging of beings with physical or with spiritual energy. And then there is the transit sleep, the unconscious slumber, when in seraphim, when in passage from one sphere to another. Entirely different from all of these is the deep sleep of metamorphosis, the transition sleep from one stage of being to another, from one life to another, from one state of existence to another, the sleep whichever attends transition from actual universe status, in contrast to evolution through various stages of any one status.
Why don't you read some more? Let's get, kind of get the whole picture. Go ahead and read those next two paragraphs.
But the last metamorphic sleep is something more than those previous transition slumbers, which have marked the successive status attainments of the ascendant career. Thereby do the creatures of time and space traverse the innermost margins of the temporal and the spatial to attain residential status in the timeless and spaceless abodes of paradise. The instigators and the complements of rest are just as essential to this transcending metamorphosis as are the seraphim and associated beings to the mortal creature's survival of death. You enter the rest on the final Havona circuit and are eternally resurrected on paradise. And as you there spiritually repersonalize, you will immediately recognize the instigator of rest who welcomes you to the eternal shores as the very primary supernifum who produced the final sleep on the innermost circuit of Havona. And you will recall the last grand stretch of faith as you once again made ready to command the keeping of your identity into the hands of the Universal Father.
Okay. So now I wanted to get all that, so I got the whole picture that we can talk about here. So this is fascinating. I mean, the physics of rest. The rest is of a sevenfold nature. Okay, so as we already were seeing, what they're talking about here is relationship to the existential and how essential it is, how indispensable it is to an experiential being. And the more there's personality in play, the more indispensable it becomes. Because where does your personality come from? From the existential deity, right? So it likes that state. That's its natural state. It needs to touch that foundation occasionally to some degree to sort of keep grounded, keep sane, as it were. So rest is built in, so they're just going up the hierarchy here. Even when you don't have personality in play directly, but just the mindedness of animals with, personality overarching all of them, the personality of the creative mother spirit overarching all those animals, in that context, you see the rest of sleep and of play, even in subpersonal creatures. So just think about what when you go to sleep tonight, fundamentally what you're doing, you're letting go of some of the intensity of motion of the experiential, of relationship with experiential deity, which is fundamentally this dynamic, moving phenomenon. You're dropping back down a little bit closer to the existential, to the foundation, kind of recharging, and then spinning back up again into relationship with experiential deity. Then it just goes, how deep do you go? How deep do you drop down? How much how much more of a re-grounding in that your existence you need before you can launch into the motion again. So the next notch up is discovery and then worship. Easiest way to think about that for you as a person is the three cosmic intuitions give you this threefold linkage into the cosmos and its existence, that it's a fact. And those two endpoints, the first cosmic intuition, the logical acumen, and the third cosmic intuition, the spiritual insight, they're really getting you, you know, grounded in the two ends, the two boundaries, the existential framework. So the second cosmic intuition is right in the middle there, the heart of the dynamic of experience, you know, your moral consciousness, you know, your duty, you know, in what you do. You know, one must do something, and one must do it right. Okay? See, that's in the center, the you know, the real experiential domain. There's these two boundaries that you can directly appreciate. On the one side, you know, that logical acumen, you can think about that, you know, in this first block here, one of the things that's there is science, discovery, knowledge. Think about facts like that. You know, that first cosmic intuition, that ability to distinguish fact from figment, to know that a fact is a fact, that it exists. That's one way you can ground yourself in the existential deity. So it's restful to discover facts and take a hold of them. It fosters the actualization of your personality. It grounds you more tightly to the source of existence, to the Father. Okay? So that. And then an even deeper one, if you ground yourself to existence on the other side with the third cosmic intuition. You know, and remember when they talk about the levels that those three intuitions are engaging, causation, duty, worship, they call those levels. You know, that third cosmic intuition engaging that worship boundary. You know, true worship is predicated on just highest pure recognition of the fact of existence in a full unity sense. The fact that unity exists. The other end was the fact that individuality exists. So it's two different degrees of closeness to the existential. Okay?
When you go into a deep, deep, deep sleep, you could be going into that. I thought it was the theta level.
Now, all that is just subdivisions of this first thing, you know, the rest of sleep. And the fact that there's various depths of sleep. Think about why that might be, why there might be sub-levels in that first stage here, or in that first fold of the sevenfold nature. Our mind is not singular. We have seven adjutants. It has depth. So, you know, you can get various degrees of rest, you know, by touching back to deeper and deeper levels. So, you know, it's not going to be a simple one-to-one correspondence or anything, but it's not surprising that there might be different levels of sleep just because we have a hierarchy of mind. And undoubtedly, a person is going to need at times to have really deep sleep in order to actually get rested, to get regrounded in existence. See? That's the thing, you know, if you don't, you know, we all know that if you actually you're forced to, you know, to stay awake, I mean, it'll drive you insane. See, you're losing your groundedness to existence. You're in this fundamentally dynamic domain of motion. Well, if motion is going to have any integrity, it has to be relative to the aisle. And if you don't keep that touchstone to the eye, if you don't keep grounded, you just become this, you know, unordered motion. You're not in orbit about anything, you might say. See? Right. So rest is very important. And so I was like to say, I mean, the deeper the, you know, the higher the personality manifestation, the deeper the rest that's required. Okay, so then they go to there's the normal rest of energy intake, they say. That's the fourth fold in the sevenfold here. Both with physical and spiritual energy. See, now you're even, you know, it's even more grounded. you have the actual substance that your mind is seated on, and having it being grounded to existential reality. You know, obviously, the seat of your mind is deeper than your mind. See, so they're speaking to that, taking it all the way down to the seat of the mind and getting it grounded in relationship to the aisle. If you don't get recharged, your very energy form will begin to become ungrounded to the aisle. You know, and if the energy foundation becomes ungrounded to the aisle, how's the mind going to stay grounded? You know, and we all know this is one of the tricks, you know, for evolutionary religion, you know, where they think that odd states of mind are spiritual. You know, they call odd mindal states spirit. And one of the ways that you can get an odd mindal state is to disrupt the relationship of your physical body to the stability of the aisle. So you do something, you know, that disrupts that physical foundation, and the mind follows it and gets this weird state. Okay? So he says, as I said, and, you know, and it's obviously, like you can see here, it's a deep rest state. So disorder in that deep level will cause very, very bizarre mindal states.
That's why they call alcohol spirits.
Right, and that's why they call alcohol spirits. Alcohol spirits and, you know, all those sorts of things. Right. Okay, so, you know, if you just think about this, you know, you can understand why this hierarchy is there. Okay, then, you know, going beyond what we can imagine, they're saying an even more deep level is when you're in seraphim. So, just pointing out that, you know, that to be in seraphim and transported somewhere is going to put you into something that really must take you like down to the ultimatonic level of your being, and just so it's a very deep thing that's being done to you to be in seraphim. You know, that they're having to grab a hold of you at a very fundamental level. So all the stuff above that, it has to be in suspended animation for the time being, because there's really almost no foundation for it to be sitting on and active and ordered. So you go into this very deep state. And then they say even deeper than that are the transformations, the metamorphic ones. And that's what we were talking about at the end last session, that there's 10 of those that you go through. You have the mortal death, first one, but then there's sort of six more mini deaths like that. You know, there's resurrection halls on all seven mansion worlds, so you die and are resurrected seven times. Well, you know, once on each of the seven mansion worlds, you have to actually have a very significant transformation of self, where, you know, you completely lose all consciousness. I mean, the mind is disconnected. They rework the foundation, and the mind is seated on it again. Okay, and then you do that where you go from Marantia to first stage spirit. You know, for us, we'll do that on Salvington. And one of the last things we do on Salvington before we head off to the minor sector headquarters. And then you've got the transition from Uversa to Havona. And then they say the 10th one is so extreme that we'll actually make it the 7th category here. So 9 of those fall into that one category. And then the 10th one is this very major one where, you know, in a sense, this reorganization of yourself is not just to a different experiential state. It's literally reorient so that it's a self that has a relationship to the existential place that you're trying to go. So they're saying that transition is even more extreme. And all of that, like I wanted to point out, how they culminate there in that third paragraph of these three that we just read. See, You will recall the last grand stretch of faith as you once again made ready to commend the keeping of your identity into the hands of the universal Father, the foundation of existence, the existential deity, to see what you're doing there, that when you die in this life, you know, or when Jesus died, you know, in Father, into your hands I commend my spirit, think of what you're doing. You're letting go to a very high degree of a relationship to experiential deity where you live. And you're dropping back down onto the floor that underlies the experiential domain, the existential domain of the Father. You rest on the Father. I mean, probably the simplest way to just visualize that, what's, of all the different facets of deity that go into make the Father, what's that last facet? Lastly, the infinite upholder. I mean, maybe we don't, you know, rest on it in some infinite level sense or whatever, but, you know, forget about the details for a moment. Just let that thought be. Someone has to uphold you when you let go of existential deity. The infinite upholder will uphold you, will maintain you. There's two things the Father does, it tells you up in the foreword. He initiates and he maintains. Here you're seeing it. You're appreciating it more directly. Him doing that second role, you know he initiated you. And every time you have to make one of these transitions, and we're just talking about the last time you had to do that, you drop back down on the existential floor. You know, that identity, you know, that self that personality identifies with and makes an identity, that self, you know, is no longer being upheld by the mother, by experiential deity. It drops back down. It relaxes. Another thing for rest is relaxation. You know, relax means to loosen back. See, now you're understanding what that is. See, back to the foundation of existential deity.
Could you think of it like when you go to sleep, deep sleep, and you're not conscious of anything, not dreaming or anything? Could it be that your thought adjuster at that point would be right there at the same level as the existential Father, and that's where he goes while we're sleeping, while we're unconscious, kind of to get more of the stability that we need in our being? And then that's why one of the reasons why we wake up, we would feel rested, because our thought adjuster has already been in that. Might be?
Okay, for those on the webinar, she's speculating about the relationship of what the adjuster is experiencing if we go into really deep sleep. If you can understand the benefit of the sleep in relative to your relationship to the adjuster. Probably the way you want to think about that is, let me start it this way. Think about what we just read. There's going to become a time when you're not going to have the kind of deep sleep experiences that you used to have. You can dwell more in intimate relationship with the adjuster for the rest of eternity, experiential eternity. When you think about your relationship to the adjuster now, the adjuster is fine just as an existence. Most of the time when you're awake and conscious, you're a random mindful form generator batting the adjuster. The adjuster doesn't need a break from that, but if you rest and wake refreshed, a little bit more grounded, and then by nature, a little bit more immediately attuned to the universal harmony. You know, you haven't started mucking with it. there's a potential in that, you know, that calm before your storm for you to have a greater relationship with the adjuster, who is the essence of calm. You know, and what you're trying to work on is more and more, you know, just walking in a peace that passes all understanding, walking in an innate, in a natural calm that is more like the inherent calm of the adjuster and having a greater relationship. Yeah, but in terms of, you know, when remember the mindful energy system is all there, your consciousness drops down, but that whole upper domain, for instance, of the mindful energy system doesn't collapse or anything. It's all there, and the adjuster's in it. You know, and like they say, the fact that you aren't up near where he is batting randomly, you know, in the mindful energy system. You drop down, and so you're batting down here, and the ripples don't really propagate that far up. You know, you're down in your subconscious domain, okay, rattling around. You know, and so the upper domain, you know, calms down, and he can build some forms up there, you know, and let material gravity slowly drift him down a little bit, you know. So when you wake up, like I was saying, if you haven't, if, you know, you don't usually wake up flailing. Okay, you wake up with a little bit of calm, and it's like, oh, what's this? Okay, you know, so that's, you know, like they say, that's how he works, you know. Yep.
Maybe I'm getting ahead, but this their use of the word metamorphosis reminded me of, you know, the prime example that we know of the caterpillar metamorphosizing into a butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
What a huge transformation that is.
Right.
So I was wondering then, if our transformation must be on a much greater scale than that.
Yeah, see,
we go from being a human being into paradise.
Well, yeah, I mean, just there's 10 of these. There's 10 of these, you know, caterpillar to butterfly. Yeah, caterpillar to butterfly transitions. The first one maybe will be a little more on the order of caterpillar to butterfly. But by the time you get to the 10th, they're saying it's such an extreme transformation, you can't even imagine it. But we want to try to help you to appreciate it by pointing out it's a whole separate category of transformation. So, you're right. I mean, see, that's why when you think about the extreme transformation of the, you know, the metamorphosis, the reforming of the self that they're going to do, you're going to go to sleep, quote unquote, and they're going to completely reshape your mindful self. So this, and they say, and as you spiritually repersonalize, okay, like I said, you have a self, so they completely rework this self, but then they reanimate it, and your personality re-identifies with it. That's the spiritually repersonalize. Even as radical as they change it, the same personality can still lock on, because they won't change that core part that the personality actually identifies with, but they're going to change everything else. Yeah, and so you will re-identify. That self will become an identity. And, you know, this is, like I said, you know, this metamorphosis, this is the extreme example that they're pointing to here compared to, like, there's even a lesser example that we won't experience. If you die before you're an independent ascender and you're repersonalized on the probationary nursery, okay, you know, there's an example where, you know, you don't go to a Marantia body. You know, they give you a material body in the probationary nursery. So it's a much, you know, smaller jump. But it's still a jump. I mean, they modify that material body some. You know, it's not reproducing and, you know, other things probably they can't even explain to us. But, they, you know, they make some modifications to it. But they make sure that that core doesn't change so that the exact same personality either re-identifies or can identify as it would if that, you know, really small child hadn't died, you know, so that it can spiritually repersonalize again. But see, that's always the case, whether or not there's just a little bit of change in the non-core self, or a huge change like this one. There's a thing that they, in that instance, when they're talking about the probationary nursery, they call that core part the potential identity. And it says that for those children that are repersonalized in the probationary nursery, the cherubim keeps your potential identity. In other words, it's got some book full of equations or something, you know, some that describes exactly what they have to build so that the core matches up and they can change everything else. But the potential identity, that part of the self that the personality identifies with, just like here, it stays the same. Okay. So yeah, and what that whole new self is going to be like, see, this is completely beyond our imagination. But it's some kind of a self that can strike step with eternity, whereas your self before could only strike step with motion. Now it can strike step with this motionless domain on the aisle. It somehow can be like it never was before, separate from doing. All right, so there you have a whole long, exhaustive thing about rest that you never imagined could exist until you found the Urantia book.
The last rest of time has been enjoyed. The last transition sleep has been experienced. Now you awake to life everlasting on the shores of the eternal abode. And there shall be no more sleep. The presence of God and His Son are before you, and you are eternally His servants. You have seen His face, and His name is your spirit. There shall be no night there, and they need no light of the sun, for the great source and center gives them light. They shall live forever and ever, and God shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. There shall be no more death. Neither sorrow nor crying, neither shall there be any more pain, for the former things have passed away.
There's a song in there.
Yeah, okay, so.
From the Bible.
Yeah, so that quote is from the Bible. Who knows where they're quoting from? Anyone know the Bible well enough?
Revelation?
Yeah, it's from Revelation. It's from Revelation. So everything except the last sentence there is from the very beginning part of the last chapter of Revelation, 22nd chapter. And of course, as always, this revelator, the perfecter of wisdom, is tweaking things a lot, of course. Okay. But you can, you know, if you go to the beginning there, you know, I don't know, like first five or something like that, right there towards the very beginning of the 22nd chapter, you'll see what he's tweaking, the sequence that he's tweaking. It's just following it along in sequence and having a lot of fun uplifting the wording. Because it obviously doesn't say great source and center and stuff like that. Okay. And then the last sentence, he's going back to the second to the last chapter, the 21st chapter. Again, right, towards the very beginning, like the fourth verse or something like that. That one, you can pull out a lot more straightforwardly if you see. It's, pretty close. That's what he's doing. So he's taking those two little poetic passages at the end of Revelation and saying, if you want a really great place to apply the truth of those two passages, here it is. They love when they can do that, when they can take something we have and lift it out of the mire that it's in and put it into its appropriate place. It's worth note, going back and reading those last two chapters of Revelation, there's a lot of, important stuff in those last two chapters. Like the 21st, the second to last chapter, that's, where they're getting Havona and Gerasim from. why they coined those names like that. That's the new heaven, you know, and the heavenly Jerusalem, you know, the new Jerusalem, okay? You know, then the new earth, of course, that's a Urantia, you know, it gives a new term there too, okay? You know, but you've got the stuff like the, you know, leaves for the healing of the nations and all those interesting little, it's all right in there. For a little homework, you can check out the last two chapters of Revelation. Okay, so yeah, we'll do the next guy here too, next group of us, Supernaphim. That was a lot of motion to get through that rest, did you notice? That took us an hour and a half.
Interesting.
All right, it's actually a very fascinating thing, all this stuff that they're throwing in here. And you notice, okay, so we got to the end, it's like, well, what exactly are they teaching me? You notice they didn't even really attempt to try to explain what they're actually going to teach you. You know, as that first phase of your tutelage on the Isle of Paradise. But like I say, you know, just rework the name. They're obviously going to be helping you, initiating you in this newfound relationship to existential eternity, and whatever the heck that means, however they do that, getting you sort of oriented in the new space that you're in. That's got to be their job. Technically, obviously, it's, you know, beyond us. But okay, so now, like I said, you again, these chiefs of assignment, they're not naming them really explain in any way that explains what it is that they teach us. Because it's really important that they give these Supernaphim this name, because they're involved in all kinds of assigning. You know, you go here, you do this. Remember we saw they were involved in, you know, in directing if someone fails to, you know, find one of the, you know, they get assigned to a super universe by the chiefs of assignment. You know, so that they wanted to give them that name because that's really the most important thing, to recognize that they're really this point of direction for who needs to do what. All right.
Number two, chiefs of assignment. This is the group designated from time to time by the chief Supernaphim, the, quote, the original pattern angel, to preside over the organization of all three orders of these angels, primary, secondary, and tertiary. The Supernaphim, as a body, are wholly self-governing and self-regulatory, except for the functions of their mutual chief, the first angel of paradise, whoever presides over all these spirit personalities.
Now, see, this is very significant that they give you this little tidbit. They're talking about the tertiary and the secondary, and now starting to introduce this to the primary. They didn't mention that there's a special angel above all angels. You know, of course, the Supernaphim are above all angels, you know. And then there's an angel above all them. There is this pattern angel. Some special first off, you know, angelic offspring of the third source and center. You'll see as we get in here why they brought it up here and not somewhere else. Because think about what I was doing when I was saying, you go over there, I'm pointing out a direction, aren't I? Saying your direction, you know, is going to be this super universe, or your assignment's going to be this. That original pattern angel is going to be very definitively a he-like fact. This directional initiation, you know, the Father is the initiator. So you're talking about initiating the whole order of angels. You lay out this direction, this pattern, that all the angels then are in a hierarchy underneath. They're doing place-like things, but it's all under and over, a superior direction over all of that, that daughter-like ministry of place and adaptability and whatnot. It's all adapting relative to that immutable direction that's established. And so that the fact that you've heard me mention this before, when you think about Supernaphim, like the fact that our chief of seraphim is a primary Supernaphim, in other words, the chief of our seraphim, instead of being a seraphim, being a Supernaphim is going to be a much more father-like influence. Everything got chaotic. And once things get kind of reconnected by a bestowal son, a point of direction comes in. So you have this more father-like influence for the, you know, the daughters, the seraphim, to realign themselves with and get directed in the right direction again. Now, it's like when we talked about those, you know, a long time ago here now, we were back in those two seraphim papers, you know, the Seraphic Planetary Government and then the Guardians of Destiny. You know, we noticed how you had one that was really talking to the mother side of the ministry, you know, whereas when you're talking about the seraphim, like the Master Seraphim, in the Seraphic Planetary Government paper, and that's a more he-like, more father-like, more direction-like influence there. So you see it here too. That even the Supernaphim, in and of themselves, can't be self-directed enough without this singular angel. You can probably even think of another example. In the local universe, there's a high sun where there's a first one that's different than all the rest. What is it?
Gabriel.
Well, that's just a singular. There's a whole order of suns in the local universe. The Melchizedek, yes. And that first Melchizedek is called the
Father
Melchizedek. That initial line of direction, see, that's laid out. All those other, you know, in general, the Melchizedeks are a more mother-like son. Right? Now, when you study that. But there needs to be this sort of direction under which they all function. It's established. So that's a similar pattern to what they're pointing out here. And then you'll notice here what they say about our relationship to these. So again, they're not going to tell you really anything about what they're going to be teaching us. It must be just sort of the next initial things after the instigators of rest in terms of getting related to paradise. But they talk about some things that we can think about more here.
The angels of assignment have much to do with glorified mortal residents of paradise before they are admitted to the core of the finality. Study and instruction are not the exclusive occupations of paradise arrivals. Service also plays an essential part in the pre-finaliter educational experiences of paradise. And I have observed that when the ascendant mortals have periods of leisure, they evince a predilection to fraternize with the reserve corps of the superaphic chiefs of assignment.
Okay, now think. So there's two things. The first part, it's like, okay, I'm getting this. They're showing you that another reason why they called them the chiefs of assignment, that you know, you're going to be doing lots of study and instruction, but then you'll get assigned to a service job, and who's going to assign you? One of the chiefs of assignment is going to assign you. It's like, okay, I get that. That's straightforward. But notice that curious thing. And I have observed that when the ascendant mortals have periods of leisure, they evince a predilection to fraternize with a reserve corps of the superaphic chiefs of assignment. Okay, before you read that, you know, back in the preface, you scan down those conductors of worship, masters of philosophy, custodians of knowledge, directors of conduct, interpreters of ethics, chiefs of assignment, instigators of rest. I mean, if you said, okay, and you can pick one of them to hang out with, would your first choice be the chiefs of assignment? Is that the most spiritually compelling name in that list? Not hardly. I think that would probably be last on the list, wouldn't it?
But yep. It would be a very predictable thing for an ascender to do, because we're such suck ups.
Gotta get it signed to the right place, right?
Think about, they're revealing something here about, you know, your destiny nature. That by the time you get here and you've really gotten yourself really purified and on task, you know, you're getting close to being inducted into the core of finality, sort of your eternity tasking, so you're moving into that space. What exactly, what kind of, are you moving into a state of place-likeness or direction-likeness? Of all the angels that you are going to be, you're going to evince a predilection to fraternize with, it's going to be these ones that are, of all the supernafim, primary supernafim, they're the ones that have been tasked to be in the most direction-like mode. The others are in a little bit more relative terms, place-like, than these. These are the most directional ones, and you're drawn to them because they're most like you, what you're striving to become. You know, a sun, right? We're all ascending suns, you know, once we fuse.
Put me in, coach.
Directing, yeah. And just to stress that, I mean, evince? Okay. I mean, the E there is a strengthener. I mean, and we're talking conquer. You know, which of the two subspecies on this planet has a predilection for conquering?
Yes.
Males or females?
Males.
See, they're very clever in their choice of words here. You know, all right. See, that's why the pattern angel, see, is mentioned here, the primary direction for all of the angels, all the way down to the cherubim and the unrevealed ones. There's this pattern direction on high. Yeah, see, so that they're pointing out that we're very much moving into a mode where the only thing that we see is eternity in our sights. You know, so there just isn't any place-like sense where I'm going to just kind of hang out. No, I want to go there. Once you know, you have your eyes set on eternity, nothing can, you know, there can't be anything but direction. You know, everything is a line heading towards eternity. Everything that you do as a finaliter is all predicated on that line of sight that you have, that bead you have on eternity. You're this very directional phenomenon. So when you think about yourself going out as a finaliter and interacting with the cosmos, like they talk about, I mean, you're gaining some stuff, but you're also you're also giving something to the cosmos when you're out and about in the seven super universe. You're a seed of some sort. You're a directional seed. Wherever you go, you leave behind alignment in your wake. You're trying to help the whole seven super universes come into the alignment that you've established on, you know, on paradise. Saying, follow me. This is the direction. Follow me. What's the connection now between finaliters and creator sons? You say, follow me. See that? When you think about, they talk about how those are such reciprocal, parallel phenomena. You know, Jesus said, follow me. That's what you are. You, without even saying anything, you just seed that into the environment everywhere you walk as a finaliter. Follow me. I have established the relationship to the way. You can follow me. It's pretty kind of an interesting thing. See that there's seeding in here between the lines. So we're gonna really love to hang out with these guys, apparently. Not the other reserve corps. These.
When you mortal ascenders attain paradise, your societal relationships involve a great deal more than contact with a host of exalted and divine beings and with the familiar multitude of glorified fellow mortals. You must also fraternize with upwards of 3,000 different orders of paradise citizens, with the various groups of the transcendentalers, and with numerous other types of paradise inhabitants, permanent and transient, who have not been revealed on your rancho. After sustained contact with these mighty intellects of paradise, it is very restful to visit with the angelic types of mind. They remind the mortals of time of the seraphim with whom they have had such long contact and such refreshing association.
Okay, just two things I want you to really notice and take away from there. You must also fraternize. See the laws in place? You can't become a finaliter until you go through all this incredible task, which are the next two groups of angels, especially the very next one, have a lot to do with helping you achieve this task, 3,000 different orders of paradise citizens, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So you must. I often will speak, you know, use that word must, and then it's like, Chris, isn't that a little harsh? It's like, no, look at the book. It says it over and over. I mean, the book is about law. You know, you must do this. You must, you know, one must do something as well as be something. Not, you know, we suggest it would be helpful if you, no, one must do something as well as be something. You have to come into relationship with law. Then the other thing is, okay, so now that we really appreciate how this is about this very compelling directional fact that they're a touchstone for, these chiefs of assignment. See, when you think about this, they remind the mortals of time of the seraphim with whom they have had such long contact and such refreshing association. But it's, the spirit is the same, but the facts are pretty different. A lot of what those seraphim are is, I need to just go to a place for a little while. So you hang out with your seraphim and you can just be there with her in that place. And it's a rest from all the direction. You must do this, you must do that. Okay? Can I just be somewhere for a little while?
Yeah. Something familiar.
Yeah. Look at how it's, remember how we talked about how everything gets reciprocated when you go into Havona? You see this again here. You know, so you're on paradise. It's this place, this eternal place. And no matter where you turn, there's all of this complexity. It's like, okay, too much place. I mean, I'm losing my sense of direction. I need to get so you go back to the touchstone. Oh, okay, there's the direction. You start to get lost in the place. It's so huge. Remember how huge it is, you know? Numbers of residences that, you know, hardly you have big enough exponents for the power of 10. You know, I mean, it's just insane how huge it is, how placey it is. Paradise area. And you get lost. You need to you need the touchstone. No, it's not complicated. Here's your direction. Okay, here's my direction. Here's my direction. Okay. Then you go at it again.
Yep. Ready to be placed out.
For people on this level who are very introverted, unless they lose their introversion, this is going to be very difficult.
Well, again, you know, there's a wonderful thing that's done to help you with that. It's called death. I mean, she's wondering about, what about introverted people in this life? You know, they're going to have a really difficult time with this. And remember, it's your mortal self that's introverted, and it dies, and it's not resurrected. Your extroverted, introverted, you know, whatever temperament self dies. It's mortal. That's why it's one of those three biggies in the transition. I mean, think about how significant that first transition is, that first transformation. right now you have two selves. I mean, set the adjuster aside. You have two selves. A Marantia self and an adjutant self. This transition to this next life is pretty extreme. One of those selves just dies. It is literally a death transition in a full sense. That adjutant self is not resurrected. It's just gone. And all the baggage that comes with it, all of the temperament of that adjutant self disappears, never to reappear again. It's only the Marantia self that's resurrected. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Those next six deaths, it's the Marantia self that, goes down and is, So it's a lesser death. That first one is a huge thing. You're just snipping it in two. And of course, it's not a very even divide since most of us, all we have is a little embryonic Marantia self, You're just snipping off the little corner and resurrecting that, and the whole rest of the sheet of paper is gone. Okay? So, and if you don't like that image, well, then you should take delight in cultivating. having your soul be more than just the corner little of the sheet of paper. Okay?
Oh, I'm a dog ear.
At least be a bigger and bigger dog ear on the corner of the paper. All right. So that's a really significant transition, like they said, as you think about it. That's why, didn't they even say it that way at the end? They said, your first transition was indeed death. It's the last time you have a mortal self. Just period. I mean, it's not even a potentially immortal self. It's just a mortal self. At least your Marantia self is potentially immortal. Okay? Not your adjutant self.
That's true. In this sentence, too, where you must also fraternize with upwards of 3,000 different orders, we don't need necessarily to imagine a big ballroom cocktail party where you're just working the crowd. In other words, I'm sure these are individual things where you can stroll off down by the river and get to know this person.
The existential river.
Yeah.
Do existential rivers flow?
I was thinking of the...
Yeah. Yep, you go ahead.
I was thinking of the bar in Star Wars. Yeah.
That's the one that pops into your head.
Yeah. So, let's see, it's probably not the bar in Star Wars. It's
not the weapons.
It's probably not the ballroom, because in that one it's across a crowded room. That doesn't happen either. So that's, that paragraph, we'll pick up the rest of the story next time with the interpreters of ethics. You're going to obviously need some help, because you must somehow establish a true relationship, with an almost uncountable number of complete oddball beings. sounds like you're going to need some help. Yeah.
Gannic intellects.
And so here you are. You're in this. You finally have this relationship with the absolute existential level that the instigators of rest, got you into, and the chiefs of assignment to help you get your initial bearings with. And now you got to put it to practice. You got to start doing something with it. You need to establish true relationship. And you're doing it now in a way you never could before, because you've got all of the bondage that your personality has been in until that point is finally liberated. The absolute dimension of your personality is now free, absolutely free to function. And so there's absolutely no limit to who you can relate to.
Finally appropriate to absolutize things.
And as they're saying it, guess what? You're going to be using it right off the bat.
And it really helps if you're thinking about these different orders of beings, to imagine them as looking like something that's really appealing on this planet, rather than imagining them, looking like starfish or something. Imagine them looking like alpacas. Something really beautiful to what you'd like to look into the face of.
Whatever your current bias of temperament, you know. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, that whole bit about, you know, someone mentioning the bar scene, you know, in Star Wars. See, you know, that's, it's so not that, you know. You know, most of what you see in that bar scene is ugliness. But also, it does have one element of truth in that bar scene. There are definitive forms. It isn't some just misty fuzz that you're wading into. You know, there's this being standing here, you know, and the reason that I'm shaped the way I am is because I'm a down-to-step expression of high pattern. So I already have some relationship of form to that being that I'll be standing in front of. He's not going to be some amorphous blob or something. He's not going to be an octopus. He's not, you know, we are made in the image of those beings in paradise. Yeah. So, you know, let us make man in our image is the line in the Bible. Right. We're reading about the our now. The host of beings that are there that we are modeled now after, patterned after. There's pattern beings, like we're reading. Okay. So you can, you don't have to imagine some bizarre science fiction or mystical or, you know, new agey or whatever experience. You can just extrapolate what you know right now. You're going to walk up to some being that you can identify as a form, and you're going to have an amazing super additive consequense. You're going to so want to must do this. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, you do it about 50 times, and oh man, can I just do this forever? I mean, the super additive consequence when you actually achieve that kind of a relationship, when you've got the full absolute dimension, you know, that has a super additive. Well, if it's absolute to absolute, super is super absolute. You're actually going to have super absolute consequences. You're going to begin to have phenomena that are touching upon a fact in reality that can't be upheld by anything except the co-infinite upholder, the infinite mother spirit.
We have the spark of the absolute within us, and they will be seeing that to facilitate the relationship. Yeah.
Finally, you'll be able to show someone that. Forever, you've been wanting to show someone who you absolutely really are. You'll finally be able to do that. You'll be so excited. But, you know, they don't let you go racing off in your excitement. You're going to need lots of help, and so that's what we're going to be reading about. All right, well, let's stop there.
We do a lot of visiting the paradise before we achieve
paradise. But like I said, you don't have any way to really...
Not fraternizing necessarily.
Right. You don't really have an outer life when you go there before. Right. See? Right. Now you have an outer life. You're a resident.
Because you're an emotion-based life form visiting the stationary.
Yeah, yeah. And so it's basically... Visitor. Yeah, it's basically not there, it seems, yeah.
Interesting experience.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a moment here.